If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share,
shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't.
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two levitators who actually experienced it. I'm Lola Blanc, expert levitator.
And I am Megan Elizabeth. I am levitating right now.
Oh my God, you are?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
The chair beneath me is an illusion.
That seems like a different thing. But today our guests are Patrick Ryan and Joseph Kelly. They are the founders of Cult News 101. They have done a lot of work with ICSA, the International Cultic Studies Association, and they are highly experienced cult interventionists. They're going to talk to us about their own experiences with transcendental meditation, or TM, early cult deprogramming and why it was problematic, and what they've learned after years of doing their own cult intervention work.
We'll discuss how most people leave cults of their own volition, why exploring someone's belief is better than attacking them, and how sometimes it can be better to let someone hold on to an untrue worldview.
I freaking love these guys. I love this episode.
I know.
I like really desperately want to have them over for dinner and pick their brains and listen to them talk forever. But before we get into it, Megan, what's the cultiest thing this week for you?
Well, I'm just reading right now about a Netflix documentary coming out about some people that we actually interviewed, which are the FLDS. This, though, is the compound down in Texas, and it's talking a lot with his son, Wendell Jeffs. He had a bunch of moms, and they were all the same age as him because he was just marrying, his father was marrying younger and younger girls. So then he's saying, you're hitting on your mom.
Right.
And they're like, I'm not actually. She's just like my age and I don't know. So this documentary, it's coming out soon and I'm pretty interested.
Me too. The Mormon offshoot community is so layered and complicated. There are so many different like subsects, and every new one that I learn about is equally fascinating and really similar in a lot of ways and really different in other ways. And yeah, it'll be presumably harrowing to hear his story.
Yeah, he's a real, real, really, really crazy person. So looking forward to hearing from his son for sure. What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
Well, first of all, I'm so tired. I can't even think, but
tell us why you finished filming.
We just wrapped our short film at five in the morning today.
Great.
It was really difficult and challenging, but great. It's going to look amazing, I hope.
Cool.
But anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about cults.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about cults in a few weeks. So I think for me, the cultiest thing is this video that I actually shared on Twitter of a man outside of an NRA convention being interviewed about how he feels about gun control. And this man is like, more people die from hammers each year than guns.
Uh-huh.
And the guy interviewing him is like, that's not true.
Uh-huh.
And the guy was like, look it up. And so the interviewer was like, okay, let's look it up right now. And they looked it up. And of course, definitely not true.
Uh-huh.
The like top two cause of death are guns. And hammers or like blunt instruments are like pretty far down the list. Obviously.
Thank God.
I think fewer people would die if hammers were the primary instrument of death. So I don't know. The interviewer is like, that's not true. I'm looking at it right here. Do you see? And the guy immediately pivoted and was like, well, I still think like they're going to take away our guns. And like just didn't, it like fully didn't penetrate that.
Yeah.
This belief that he had was wrong. And it was just really interesting to watch it in real time, because that is exactly what we talk about here all the time, which is that like attacking people with facts, it just makes them defensive about their worldview because their worldview is so tied in with their identity.
Yeah, you can't just deconstruct someone with a fact.
Right. Like, I can imagine being in that position and being at this place where I've found a lot of community with other, you know, fucking gun owners, and someone is basically hitting me with facts to, I can imagine that feeling like they're trying to rip away my community on some subconscious level. You know what I mean?
And of course.
Yeah, it's so interesting because you think logic is going to work, you know? You think it's going to be the thing. And in this episode, we will learn more about why that's not the case.
I just saw that they gave away at a raffle a gold-plated, like, assault rifle, which was just...
Oh, my God.
The most evil thing I've ever seen. Like, I'm not even anti-gun or anything like that, but that is just sick.
I mean, we've already talked about the gun thing, so I don't need to get into it, but the, like, worship of the NRA and of fucking military-grade weapons designed to kill humans, the worship of that is, like, fucking terrifying to me.
It truly is not good, so, yeah.
I love going shooting. I love going to the gun range, but that shit is scary.
Yeah, just, it seemed like, read the room, and by the room, I mean... humanity, and maybe this specific week don't gold plate a tragedy
after 19 children were just killed.
Anyway,
so that's another cold thing, but you guys, I'm tired. We're gonna get into this interview now.
Yeah, let's get into the interview. This interview is great. You weren't tired for the interview, so don't worry about that, and enjoy it.
Okay, let's go. Welcome, Patrick Ryan and Joseph Kelly. Should we call you Joseph or Joe?
Joe.
Hi, Joe Kelly. I've been hearing about you guys from my mom for years, actually.
Yeah, we love Christine.
So you run Cult News 101, is that right?
Yes.
And you've both done extensive work with ICSA, which is the International Cultic Studies. No, I'm going to get it.
It used to be called the American Family Foundation, but that sounded too much like a Christian group called the American Family Federation. So they had to change that up, and the board decided that ICSA would make a lot more sense.
I like it.
ICSA has been around for about 42 years. I don't want to call ICSA an anti-cult organization, but in the realm of organizations that deal with cultic groups, ICSA was more of the academic side originally, and they continue to produce academic journals on the study of influence and control. And ICSA also has a support system and recovery for people. So I worked for them for 23 years up to 8 years ago. And Joe for not as long, but for a long time.
Wow, shots fired.
What's wrong with being anti-cult?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Well, first you have to define the word cult. I mean, are we talking about Wiccan wisdom? Are we talking about things that are different from mainstream and yet, you know, are, you know, what one might call a cult? There are cults within the Catholic Church, the cult of Mary. You know, do we want to classify everything as negative just because of the word cult? We've come to familiarize ourselves with the term, and it makes us, you know, it kind of makes it compact and easier to understand. And it can be very helpful for people in the beginning stages of leaving an organization which is problematic and toxic. And
right.
It can be a cultic relationship between a husband and wife, or it can be a large group, group awareness training. All of those could be cultic in some dimension. And the relationship of an individual with that group is specific to that person. So you'll find many people went through Nexium. We all know Nexium now. You know, Keith Raniere, you know, the, you know, Predator.
We've been following it. Yep.
Yeah. And yet there were 14,000 people that took part in his programs that he put forward. They weren't all cult members, but that center core, that group at the top of that pyramid structure, you know, DOS, and then following down from there, were more and more committed to the ideology and his program.
I know actually people who were in Nexium, but not in Nexium. Like we talk about that a lot, how everyone's experience with an organization can be completely different, and some are in a cult and some are not. Go on, Patrick.
So on the issue of, by not be anti-cult, that's it's a very good question. So Joe is bringing up there's definitional issues. There's a sociologist's definition. There's a people who study religion, their definition. We from ICSA more come from a psychological perspective. So there's that perspective. So there's all different kinds of organizations that may be cultic in some nature. But Joe and I deal with people that who are in influence situations that maybe wouldn't fit the classic definition that someone would want to give of a cult. But that doesn't address why we are not anti-cult. So I was in a group, Joe was in a group, And we both sued the groups that we were in. I was sued in federal court for fraud and negligence.
Wow.
And I certainly was anti-cult. So I'm 64. I started when I was 17. That's when I got into the group. So when I was 23, 24, I got out and I was very angry at the group. I was, you know, picketing. I was anti-cult. And nobody from that group would talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that group, I became the enemy, the personification of the devil.
In Scientology terms, the SP, or suppressive person. Yeah. Good on you.
So it is, there is a role for people to be exposing groups. But when you're doing the work, kind of work that Joe and I do, which is intervention work or mediation work, it doesn't make us that neutral party that can help someone reconnect with their family. So for our approach to intervention, so to speak, it's not helpful for us to be anti-cult people, so to speak.
Right. Sometimes I feel like the language people have around cults is lumping everyone from the group together as though the victims of the leader are bad, when in fact they are indoctrinated and they're being controlled and manipulated. So to me, and that's what I think of when I hear anti-cult, it's like, no, we're not anti-cult. We're anti-cult leader, right? We're anti-abuser.
We're anti-victimizer and pro-victim. We really want to support the people who have seen clear of it. I live in this community in South Philadelphia, which is a lot like Brooklyn. It's gentrifying. It's very different from the place that I first moved to when I was in the group 40 some years ago, when properties were dirt cheap and you could find a place for $7,900 to live. Now there's places selling for $1.2 million. So by way of comparison, the neighbor who shows up at my doorstep now is someone who's saying, hey, I heard you guys are the cult guys. I was born and raised in 3HO. What advice do you have for me? And it's so different. There's so much information for them to have already absorbed, yet there's still the difficulty in stepping through the information about the negativity of the group. So they've read what they found on the internet, which wasn't available when Pat and I first, you know, left our groups.
Mm-hmm.
None of that existed. It was newspaper articles, if you could find them, and devoted ex-members who were out there, you know, flying the banner of freedom of thought. It was a very different feeling. Now it's all there, pro and con. Make your decision. And who are we to say that you're right or wrong if you've read all the con and you're still deciding to enjoy yourself with a group that is considered problematic? So it becomes much more complicated and more nuanced. What are the influences put to bear on the individual that are causing them to commit to something that the world has seen, you know, the larger world, as problematic and toxic? What do we do with that?
Well, I want to ask you both about your personal experiences. If you can kind of give us the nutshell version. We were both a part of TM, is that right?
Yes,
that's right.
So how did you both join, first of all, in the first place? And then we can kind of get into how you got out.
This is Pat Ryan. So I was in high school. I wrote for my high school newspaper in St. Petersburg, Florida. And TM, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Beatles guru, appeared on a TV show called The Merv Griffin Show. It was a very popular show at the time. And about 40,000 people started learning TM a month in 1975.
TM, for anyone who doesn't know, stands for Transcendental Meditation.
Contemporary practitioners would be David Lynch, Jerry Seinfeld, Russell Brand. These are all people who promote and use transcendental meditation as they present it an adjunct to their lives.
Right, right, right.
So I went to write this story about TM because it was popular. And when I walked into the center, I'm from St. Petersburg, Florida, the Philadelphia Phillies, the baseball team, spring train in the town next to it, Clearwater. And so when I walked in, there was famous athletes. So I'm like 16 years old, 17 years old, and there's these famous athletes there. So I ended up taking the course. And because I was young, they were very nice to me and very kind. And they encouraged me almost immediately to go on an advanced course, which was a week long.
Mm.
And that course was taught by Mia Farrow's sister.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Prudence Bruns. So, you know, the song, the Beatles song, Dear Prudence, Won't You Come Out and Play? It's written about her.
Oh, wow.
She was the person who taught the course. And so I'm there. The Maharishi had just started a university And so she encouraged me to go to the TM University. So within a few months of learning, I informed my parents that I was not going to where they expected I was going. But I was going to the Maharishi U, which didn't go over real well. just to give you context, my dad's from South Dakota. My grandparents homesteaded a farm, and he was a high-ranking military guy. And his son says, I'm going to go off and study Hinduism.
Oh, man, yeah.
But they came to understand that if they wanted to have a relationship with me, they had to go along with this because I had sort of switched my fundamental assumptions about how the universe worked and how I was going to get off the planet rather than being a good Irish Catholic kid. Was I had a new worldview.
Yeah.
And I was special. It was very powerful and amazing. So at 17, I loaded up my VW and went to the university in Iowa, where I spent 5 years.
If you could sum up your new point of view on life in one sentence, what would it be?
When he joined, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So being from an Irish Catholic family, there's Mary, Joseph, Jesus, whatever, and how you get off the planet. I don't know. Adam and Eve did something wrong. And somehow we had, the nuns called it a milk bottle, our soul, which was filled with bad marks. And we had to cleanse it, or we'd end up in something called purgatory. I mean, we had this heaven and hell, and that's how you got off the planet. That's sort of this fundamental assumption of how you see the world. Mm-hmm. The TM worldview is different than that. The TM worldview comes from more of an Eastern worldview that says that all of us can become a god.
Right.
All of us were once a spark, and we go through 3.5 billion lifetimes as an ant, as a frog, as a roach, as a whatever, until we become a human. And then once we're a human, we have this unique opportunity that we can transcend and get off this wheel of this cycle of birth and death called samsara. And this is the opportunity. And to waste this lifetime by not getting off, by not getting enlightened, would be like selling a diamond for the price of spinach. It would be a complete waste. Mm. So these are two different worldviews. And so when you adopt this new worldview, then you reinterpret your past in terms of the new view.
Yep.
That raises a really interesting point here is how did you get from doing a technique that promotes relaxation and better grades and improve physical health to the point where you believe that it's going to lead you to eternal destinies?
Right.
Was that what was promised in the beginning? No, we didn't know that at all.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
It wasn't fully informed consent. And that's how we distinguish a group that one might call cultic from one that might be more mainstream. So if I wanted to convert to Judaism today, I would go to the local synagogue. There'd be a rabbi there. He'd say, here's what we believe. This is our belief system. Choose it, believe it or not. And if you don't believe it, then, you know, there's other places you can go. Whereas with groups that are considered cultic, they don't offer you the full agenda.
Right. Much like Scientology.
Exactly.
These types of religions, and TM, although claims it's not a religion, is a religion, are Gnostic religions. And they're religions that Gnostic is sort of hidden knowledge. So the justification from a Gnostic system is that we dole it out as people are ready. There could be an understanding why you would not tell someone the whole truth. And in TM, that was called telling people the sweet truth. Maharishi would say an elephant has two sets of teeth, one to show people and one that bites. Mm. You have two different levels of going on. I went to the university, which is an accredited university through the PhD level, but it's changed. And that's a good thing from when I went in 1975. So in the time I was there for about 5 years, I spent 18 months with my eyes closed in month and 3 month long blocks, about 20, 22 hours a day.
Whoa.
Doing these meditation. And we came to believe we could learn to levitate to save the world.
Wow.
Lots of hopping on foam pads, rooms filled with foam pads. 2,500 people all meditating together and hopping, physically hopping on their haunches.
Wow.
In order to improve the destiny of the world.
You're being negative by calling it hopping. When I learned...
Oh, yeah. What's the word for it? To make it not weird.
It was called levitation.
At first.
Oh.
And the literature that they published said that the body lifts up, moves 6 foot forward, and gently comes to the ground. The people who said to me that they could do it were a Nobel Prize winner, Brian Josephson, who got the Nobel Prize in physics.
No.
No way.
Yes. The lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania, Scranton. There were all of these... very well established, somebody from CERN in Switzerland, from the particle accelerator laboratory. They said that they took the course and they levitated.
No way.
Wow. What the credibility that lends to that practice.
Amazing credibility. So it was called levitation. It was very secret, the whole process. But we believed, or we were taught, that by practicing this levitation in groups, we could stop wars. And indeed, people were sent into war zones in Nicaragua, Iran, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, into hotel rooms covered in foam rubber, theoretically levitating to stop wars.
And what was the alleged mechanism behind that? How would the levitation, how was it supposed to help?
It was a square root of 1% of the population of the world practicing these very highly advanced yogic techniques that would then clear the atmosphere for all of mankind. So,
like karmically?
Exactly. Clean the karmic air so that the bonds of karma would no longer be held down on humanity. So we really felt like, wow, you know, here we are doing something extraordinary. We didn't have to join the local socialist group or march against the war. We just had to transcend. And in that transcendent state, we were purifying all of our neighbors around where we sat. And they were benefiting from it. And we were then becoming more highly advanced human beings.
This is the, as Joe is explaining, a little bit more of what you would tell the public. There was the public view that this is somehow creating orderliness in the consciousness of the universe. Mm-hmm. But then there was the internal story. And the internal story is a lot different. So the internal story is that if I drop a pen on the, you know, on my desk, a law of nature is operating, and that's called gravity. And we were taught that gravity had an operator, like a puppeteer who runs gravity. And every law of nature had a puppeteer, so to speak. And those are called the devas. And those are the gods. So everything in the universe, all the things that make the universe work and function, are controlled by these devas. And they're asleep, the ones that make the world a better place. The ones that are not so good, that create wars and conflict, they're awake. And what we have to do is wake up the sleeping gods by giving them their sustenance, their food. And that's produced in our digestive system when we meditate. So we would produce this in our digestive system, and then we would do these incantations to send this substance called soma to the ruler of the gods called Indra, and Indra would then dole it out to where it needed to go.
Why are all cultic groups, why are their belief systems so complicated? It's so complicated. It can never be a simple answer, you know?
And they always claim it is not complicated. They're like, the truth is simple, man.
If you don't think it's simple, it's your problem.
And that's the unique thing, that they say it's not complicated because at the outset, they want as many members as possible, bringing in dollars, pounds, and, you know, euros into the fund of the group. So whatever it takes to simplify it is what the group wants to do in order to enlarge and grow the ideals of leadership. Some leaders are very, you know, greedy, they are power hungry, and they want that power and control over their individual followers. And other groups last through time. You know, if you're anybody's watching Under the Banner of Heaven, it's a powerful story. And it shows that there's many different understandings of what Mormonism is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one thing.
Former Mormon here.
Yeah. So I think it's the same for those of us who are involved in transcendental meditation.
Right.
What happened with the Joe and myself is we were in this belief system and we knew sort of the what we would tell the outside and what was on the inside.
And you guys are so sleep deprived, right?
No. In fact, the opposite. So when I was at the university, Jonestown happened in 1978. And I freaked out a little bit. I'm like, oh shit, what is this? What's happening to us? And so I started reading about cults. And they said there's sleep deprivation. At the university, we had to have 8 hours sleep a night. They said there was bad food. We had the best food. So all the things that people said, the principle is that groups affect your critical thinking. So when you meditate as much as we did, critical thinking decreases and you become more suggestible. So you can get people into a suggestible state by different approaches, sleep deprivation being one, or increase the amount of meditation is another approach. The same thing happens, but it just happens in a different way.
Right.
I believed it, that I was so afraid I was in a cult that I went to New York City over a spring break, and I knew about the Moonies, and I went and stood by Penn Station, and I got recruited three times and went through their workshops and to see like, well, what does brainwashing look like? But it just didn't make sense to me because it wasn't like anything that I was being described. They didn't do that to me at the Moonies and it didn't seem right in TM. So ultimately what happened to me, and this affected Joe, is Maharishi wanted us to move into cities. And we came into this very marginal area of 16 of us, and we bought up a bunch of houses, $1 to $7,000. And we created an ideal village in theory. And in that, I got a phone call one day from my dad, and he said, son, I'd like you to come home and talk to your sister. She joined a cult.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, what do you mean? He said, you know, I said, Dad, she's a crazy Christian nut. She had joined the Way International, and I really don't want to talk to her. And so my dad said, look, I've supported you in every thing you've ever wanted to do in your life, including going to this Maharishi University. I'm asking you to come home and talk to your sister because she will not talk to any of us. There's five of us, but two of us joined groups.
I'm one of seven and I'm the only one.
Okay.
So I went to Florida, got my sister and ultimately got her to come back to Philadelphia to meet a woman named Lois Patton, who was a programmer. And so in my house, this woman started talking to my sister about how cults work, how influence works, how disguise techniques of hypnosis work, how you can use behavior modification. And as she was talking to my sister about this Christian group, I was going, oh my God, that's what they do to me. Mm. And so because it wasn't directed at me, it was directed at my sister.
Right.
I could make the connections. And fundamental to our approach to doing intervention is based upon that experience. We're not attacking anyone. We might have a discussion, open discussion about ideas and concepts.
No finger wagging. No, you're in a cult. Mm. I found out all this information on the internet, and therefore you have to look at the same information and come to the same conclusions. When really an individual is having an internal experience unlike anything they've had up to that moment, and anything that they've had within the family system. So they can't relate to the parents' complaint. They see the parents' complaint as being dark, mm-hmm. and they see their experience as being alleviating some issue or problem that they've been struggling with over the course of time. So how do you bridge that? How do we come together and have a discussion on, even while you're experiencing something extraordinary, we see down the road that train that you're on, the track is out, you know, at mile marker 223. And that's been proven over time. And there's many people who've reported that same experience. But for you now, you're on the most beautiful train ride with beautiful scenery on either side. And so you can't imagine that your family has anything to offer you at this point.
Mm.
So the family has to understand how to approach you respectfully, patiently, and not rush into this without being fully informed about where you may be at any given point.
And not literally kidnapping you and telling you that your beliefs are wrong.
No, we know people who've been kidnapped, and we're going back to the 70s, and we met them at what was then called the Cult Awareness Network conferences, where we would sit in large groups of ex-members, maybe 30 to 50 people, and we'd all discuss our unique experiences in being in groups. And it would be New Age, it would be Christian, it would be Eastern, it would be guru-based, it would be one-on-ones, as they call them. So you had a real variety of people coming from many different backgrounds, sharing their moment of what caused them to stop and pause. What was it that led them to leave?
Mm-hmm.
What gave them the strength? And the general theme is that people leave because it's no longer useful to them, to them as an individual, and not because somebody's telling you this is what you must believe. And so those people who were deprogrammed, some of them were grateful, but almost seemed like they were the walking wounded. They left the groups traumatized by the cult and then re-traumatized by the leaving experience. And that really caught me off guard because I didn't have any of those experiences. My experience getting in was much more gentle, and my experience leaving had to do with like Pat had discussed, with his sister standing at a distance. I was involved in a legal action against transcendental meditation. And as a result of that, I met with some of what were considered at that time the world experts on thought reform or mind control. Dr. Margaret Singer, Dr. Lewis Jolly and West, these names you may have heard, they're kind of considered to be, icons in the field. And these were people that were my individual counselors and were advisors on the lawsuit that led me out of my cultic thinking. And it was soon after that that some of those individuals said, hey, you guys have a great story that might help others. Why don't you think about sharing with others? And and that's more or less the way that our experience as exit counselors grew, from seeing what we didn't want to be, the deprogrammer, going back to, the Ted Patricks and others who felt kidnapping was the only method or solution to this problem, and moving into something much more respectful and gentle.
I was just going to ask, if most people leave on their own, what is the importance in bothering to try to convince them?
Well, this is a good question. The research indicates, and it's not perfect research, we're talking psychological research, but about 90% of people who join groups leave, and they leave them on their own. But what we don't know is if it's after a week or if it's after 50 years. We just know that most people leave on their own. But a substantial minority of those people are harmed, maybe psychologically, physically, or in some way. So there's the universe of people who've learned transcendental meditation, about 10 million people. There's another universe, a subuniverse of people that were teachers of TM, maybe 40,000 of us. So these are the people who did the advanced things that I was describing. Mm. So the 10 million.
Yeah, I'm one of the 10 million. It did not ruin my life. I'm fine. Yeah. Got blackout drunk once and screamed my secret mantra to be funny. So.
Well, now you have to tell us, Megan.
Well, now you're in trouble.
Okay, we have to cut this interview short. I'm spooked.
There's this universe of people who learn TM. We're using that as the analogy. There's a subuniverse of people who were teachers of TM. And then there's a subuniverse of those people who felt in some way they were psychologically harmed by this experience. And that's the people that we're concerned with. And that's in some way why we're not anti-cult, because we can label TM, it has cultic attributes at some levels. When you learn TM, you are lied to. There's no doubt about it. The teacher didn't tell you the truth about a number of things because they thought that they knew better than you. You paid too much money for learning to TM. Okay, that's fine. But whatever it is, but you're not in a cult. The level of being a teacher is someone where we knew we were lying to you. We knew we were trying to save your soul. We knew the secrets. Mm. So I think that groups are like that. There's all these different levels. And so why interfere with someone's life without their permission? And that's what an intervention is. And that's a question that I ask families all the time. What right do you have to interfere with your loved one's life? They hire us to come and help them to address the situation. And then we ask this question, what right do you have? We want the families to understand what first the person loves about this group. It's like, because it's like falling in love, being in a group. And what do they think is wrong? Or how is this affecting someone's life in a way that's not healthy for them? And what do they see? They have to have good reasons. And so we help families distill their concerns. And the idea that just because you're in a group, somebody called it a cult, or someone said you were brainwashed, that's not good enough for me. Mm-hmm. It really has to be distilled to something that is meaningful. That this person, is not functioning. They can't hold on a job. They have abandoned their children. I'm giving extremes here.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just talking to an ex-member of ISKCON, International Society of Christian Consciousness, or Hare Krishna Movement. In the 90s, there was a group called the Straight Edge. It was a hardcore music scene group.
Oh, Straight Edge. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of recruitment being done by bands, Shelter 108, in the hardcore music scene amongst young kids. These would have been, 13 to 18-year-olds, not always, well thought through in their decision-making process, but it was a blast. I just was looking at a video the other day of Shelter. There was a place called in Philadelphia called the Vampire Club, which was where people went for hardcore music in the 90s and 2000s. These kids were so enthralled with the message of the hardcore music scene and being different from their parents who were sexually free and fluid, and straight edge was no meat eating, no sex without true love, which fit really neatly in with regulative principles of the Hare Krishna movement. And so here was a group that was promoting values that we would otherwise think were good, right?
Yeah.
But then these kids were failing out of school. They were encouraged to chant 16 rounds a day, which is an enormous number of hours of chanting, made their minds into mush when they needed to be focusing on their studies. And so there was that negative side. The organization didn't see how to kind of modify their teachings to this younger audience. They just dealt with the fundamentalism of leadership, which said, this is what we do. We do 16 rounds a day, which is like 3.5 hours of chanting. And that's it. And that's the beginning. And if you don't do that, you're not a true member.
This was the straight edge scene?
Yeah, within it.
Okay. People thought I was straight edge all the time because I didn't drink or smoke. And I was a virgin while going to punk shows. But I was like, I don't know what that means. I just don't drink or smoke. I thought it was just sort of a loose thing that people would identify with.
Yeah. So within straight edge was the Hare Krishna movement, which was kind of using the straight edge scene as a vehicle for them to promote their own ideology and recruitment to bring young people into temples.
Brilliant.
So some of the big bands that were very well known, 108, Shelter, Cro-Mag, those bands were Krishna members.
I did not know that. That's so interesting. Okay.
And that's how it sort of flies.
But then there were other people in the straight edge scene who were completely independent of all that and didn't abide by it because they felt that the Krishna members were anti-feminist, which they were, because the founder of the Hare Krishna movement said that women's brains were half the size of men's.
Oh,
well, true, you know.
That was written in their scripture. And to be one of us, you have to be a believer in those ideals.
On that one is a sort of a funny experience I had. I was doing an intervention with a young Krishna guy that had really gone off the edge. And he believed, because the leader taught, that man's brain is 64 ounces and a woman's brain is 32 ounces.
Wow.
The most smartest woman is always less intelligent than the most stupid male.
Mm-hmm.
And so his sister was like the head of some major medical field in Canada. And so we were talking day after day. And finally, I arranged to go to a morgue to weigh brains. And then we didn't go and do it.
Oh, damn.
Because when you have absolute truth, if there's one error, then you don't have absolute truth anymore. So people who believe that the philosophy is absolutely correct, there can't be any part of it that's wrong.
Mm. This reminds me of Christians who think that men have more ribs.
Yes.
I just read yesterday that somebody took one of their family members to a morgue. They were a doctor and showed them they have the same amount of ribs.
Are you freaking kidding me? I had no idea that anyone...
Eve was made out of
that. Yeah. So, you know, all guys have, you know, one more rib.
Sure, they do. Count them. No.
Yeah. Yeah. So when they get that real proof, he didn't want it anymore. He didn't want to go weigh the brain, or he
was holding on.
There were other things going on in the exit counseling that became just one issue of many to challenge his beliefs. And this is what we hope to do. It has to be relevant to the individual who's struggling with these issues and relevant to the family who are coming forward with their complaints, which may have nothing to do with why the person got involved in the group. So we have to respect the individual in the group and see, okay, what is it that's attractive in this? Does your parent even understand you might be better off than where you were previously?
Do you find that there are instances where people are like, my family member's in a cult, and you're like, but they're fine and we don't need to do anything? Like, does that ever happen?
Yeah, well, yes, in some way. We might feel the thing that they're involved in is not healthy for them.
Mm-hmm.
But because research tells us that most people leave, if we see them showing signs of leaving, then you don't want to stop that process. The example I would use is, you know, when I was 17 or 15 years old and you're dating somebody and your parents don't like them, you're going to date that person.
Yeah.
And so if you can just let go a little bit, most people will just move through the experience.
Interesting.
So the secret to knowing our success in helping people reevaluate their involvement has to do with knowing what's going on in their head. So when I was at the TM movement at the TM University, there were hundreds of times you as strangers could have talked to me and I would have left. And there were times that you could have brought in an army and I wouldn't have budged. And the difference could be a week. Mm. It's just you had to know if I was happy or not happy. So there were times where there was one time that I was so unhappy that my friend and I jumped on a freight train and you know, we went across the state of Iowa on a freight train because I hated being there so much. Mm. And then I went, oh my God, I was so wrong. And I went back. So there were times where you want to leave and times you don't want to leave, but you get stuck in this idea of this is how I'm going to get off the planet. But you just have to know what's going on in someone's head. So if you show someone respect, and you show them, you try to understand it through their eyes, what do they love about this? I believe personally that you guys, you women, everyone knows what their parents think about everything. I certainly knew what my mother thought and dad thought about everything. When the telephone would ring, when it was the old fashioned phone would ring, I could tell by the sound of the first word out of my mother's mouth how the conversation was going, right? You know what they think. So you don't need to tell your kid, this is what's wrong with it. This is what we don't like, because they already know you don't like it. So I think that your job is to try to find out what they love about it so that you become a safe place for them to create an easy glide path to come back to somewhere. But if you're an antagonistic person to their involvement, and you might be, you know, some groups are people die. So there may be a reason to be, but you've got to look at the situation. Not all groups are Jonestown. Not all groups are Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of groups, and there's, you know, a few of those. So it's just learning and making judgment.
It's interesting that the way you describe it, Pat, because, you know, I went from one group to the next day. Within the TAM community, there were a group of us who joined and got involved with this guy named Swami Prakashan on Saraswati, who was many years later found out to be a perpetrator of sexual abuse on young girls within his sect. And I was involved in the very early stages of him developing his group. And he was an Indian man who moved onto a small dead-end street in South Philadelphia where we were all transcendental meditators. It split the group down the middle. Mm. Some of us went with the Swami. Others, Pat, stayed with the Maharishi. And what was interesting was that it took me 5 more years. So when Pat was introducing his sister to information about cults,
I was in TM.
He was in TM, and I happened to walk through the house because we were all living in a kind of communal situation. And he said, Joe, come here, sit down, take a look at this video. And I sat there for a minute, and, you know, took in a little bit, immediately got twigged that this was something that was going to shake my world, and got up and ran out the door. Mm. So it wasn't my moment. And it took me 4 more years to come to the conclusion that what I was seeing in group number 2 was the same thing that caused me to leave group number 1. But it took a lot of time. And one of the things, a simple question was asked to me by Dr. Margaret Singer when she was interviewing me for the litigation against TM. She said, so Joe, tell me, just, you know, for my own information, what is it that you think is different about your involvement with the Swami as opposed to your involvement with Maharishi? Mm. And I said, oh my God, there's so many differences. Let me tell you, you know, the group number 2 is true Hinduism. Group number 1 was phony Hinduism.
False gods.
Yeah, false gods and, you know, bells and whistles, but nothing serious. How can anybody take seriously that you're doled out a mantra by age and sex, or however they gave them at that time,
right,
which varied. Whereas with Swamiji, you could sit there in the room, and I was like mesmerized because the man was there, the person, the guru, the God man, the figure that I imagined would come into my life and transform me that I read about in books. When the disciples ready, the guru comes. The guy knocked on my door, bang, 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 in a row home in South Philadelphia. How much more magical, mystical, and true could that be?
You're on a hero's journey of epic proportions at that point.
At that point, you are blindsided. You're experiencing something that you can't explain easily to people outside of the spiritual realm. Because if you've never experienced that transformation or that moment of conversion that you feel like transforms your moment in history, I now know what truth is. And they're sitting there and you're feeling it. It's all like your body is a part of that experience. How can that be negated easily by simple ideas? You need to walk through it. Yeah. And you need to see the warts. You need to begin to see the problems arising within the group.
Right. I really like how you said it wasn't my moment, because I think, you know, a lot of people, we expect someone who's going down a rabbit hole, be it QAnon or whatever it is, we're like, this should have been the thing. You should be able to see this. How did this not get you out? And it's like, you kind of have to have this extreme patience with the person that you love, which is really, really hard. And so I wanted to ask you guys, and practically speaking, how do you show somebody that you care about them, that you're there for them, that you're not attacking their belief system without enabling potentially harmful behaviors?
I think that you show them what we would call benign curiosity. Some trying to understand, you know, you see your loved one involved in something that's very difficult for you to wrap your head around. You say, can you help me get there? I want to understand what you see, but I'm struggling. Help me get there. Help me understand, so that you're an ally, not an adversary. I believe that if you're in a bad relationship, and some people start telling you you're in a bad relationship, well, then you can fight against those people that are telling you. Your sister says this is a bad relationship. Your mother said you're in a bad relationship. You're fighting. But no one's talking about it, you're left by yourself, you can feel it's just a bad relationship. I don't belong here. And can they create a way for you to come out? And so that's in some way what we try to create. Now, you have to make distinctions, because some groups are very toxic and you might have to escalate because of a particular place of where someone is in their life. But in QAnon is a good example. You know, during the craze part of before the election, we had about 100 families contact us. And of those 100 families, two of the people had loved ones that were in mental hospitals as a result of their involvement. So those were the ones we were concerned about. And we made a prediction, you know, not a psychic, that when the election occurred, about half the people would disappear. And certainly when the election occurred, it just sort of went away, because they families weren't fighting them about QAnon. Then when the thing happened in the Electoral College, about half of those people went away. Then when the thing happened on January 6th, about half of those people
went
away.
That's so interesting.
So it got smaller and smaller down. And I think that what I was going to say before is we all are connected for different reasons. And we all leave for different reasons. It's not one thing. It's not that it's mind control or abuse. It's different things for different people. For me leaving Tim, it's a theological a reason that's so obscure that it would make no sense to anyone. But it's the thing that I thought, oh, this isn't accurate. And so because that wasn't accurate, I could question other things. So when I said I sat through my sister's sort of intervention, it took me a year to leave TM. I was doing interventions, helping people leave groups, but I was still in TM.
Wow.
But what the intervention with my sister did was allow me to ask questions that I wasn't allowed to ask. And when I say I wasn't allowed to ask, I didn't allow myself to ask, because I knew if I asked those questions or opened those doors, it was the house of cards was likely to fall. And I loved it too much. And so when I left at about 23, 24 years old, I didn't tell my parents for 3 years that I was out, because I was too embarrassed. Because when I got involved, the first thing they did was take me to the priest. I got the priest involved to learn to meditate. Their friend was a shrink. They had me talk to their shrink friend. I got the shrink to learn to meditate. everybody that they got me to talk to, I would get to meditate.
Oh my gosh.
You just get them to join, Tim.
Don't talk to this guy.
I got Everybody, all my siblings, nephews, nieces, the only person, one sister and my father, I couldn't get involved. And my father, when I would try to get him to learn, and he would say, son, what you love doing is meditating. And what I love doing is riding horses. And if I had 10 extra minutes in a day, I'd ride a horse. Do what you love. This is what I love. He would never make me wrong.
I love that.
I had the ego of a young man who just had a lot of pride and didn't want to say it was wrong. So when I would go visit my parents, my mom would say, Pat, it's 4. We're going to eat at 6. You better go meditate, because it was 2 hours. And I would go sit in a room and go, how do I tell them? I just couldn't do it, because it, in some sense, it wasn't safe.
Yeah.
Emotionally. And what we try to do is to create a safe space for people to come back to. And that might not be to the mom and dad, but it might be to the sister, an aunt, uncle, a cousin, a friend, someone that it's safe. So that's what we really focus on in our work, is creating a safe place and an easy glide path back to, you know, this world.
Do you typically work with people who are like, they're sort of already coming out of it and you help them transition, or people who just have, they're like in it still?
Both. I mean, I've been doing interventions for 38 years.
Wow.
I've done a lot of these things. So there's a whole host of them. But the thing that, you know, I learned is that most people leave, and they leave on their own, if we can just get out of the way.
So when we go to X member conferences, you know, 80% of the people are walkaways.
Mm-hmm.
They're not programmed. People have come to their own conclusions and they want to share their life experience. And that helps us as interventionists, but intervention doesn't necessarily mean, you know, certainly not the programming model of the 1970s, and something very different from what people imagine it to be even today, like a drug and alcohol model, which would be everyone sitting around with their letter, you know, speaking out their truth and how they've been hurt by the individual who's using substance. It's quite different. It's really about respect and understanding.
People get things out of groups, be it Scientology or any group.
Of course. Or why would you join? Yeah.
Well, yeah. So I was an incredibly shy person that was like immobilizingly shy. And you know, then I was up giving lectures before 100 people. I mean, something changed. So I got something out of that experience. So we have to acknowledge what people get out of it. And sometimes families are toxic, and sometimes relationships are toxic.
It is true that sometimes the cultic group is a respite,
mm-hmm. right,
for individuals who are struggling with a very difficult familial relationship or personal relationship. And that has to be acknowledged, and we have to sort that out. And that's why we're always involved. We always involve a marriage and family therapist and a psychiatrist in reviewing our caseload, so that we know, are we going down the right path with this family?
Right. You don't want to bring them back into another abusive environment.
Exactly.
Yeah. We want a safe place for them to come out of.
And families need to do a lot of work on their own, independent of the group. And yet the group involvement may bring it all to a head and bring it to light, whereas, you know, this has been ongoing.
There's a concept of radical departures. And the concept was mostly written or talked about the people that were part of the Lubavitch movement in Brooklyn, the Hasidic Jews. Mm. And these are where there's arranged marriages. It's a little FDList.
Ultra-Orthodox.
So sometimes people will leave that and become a Rajneeshi, this radical departure, so that they can ultimately come back and be themselves. And so groups can be used for purposes.
Interesting.
You find people who are gay joining groups, because then they maybe join a celibate group, because then they don't have to deal with that in their family. So it can be a stepping stone of understanding. So I'm not trying to promote groups. I just think that it's very important that we look at the nuance and we try to understand for each individual, what is it that the hooks for them? And is this something that's going to naturally end? Or is it something that we need to push along?
The cult that I was raised in, it's like 4 generations back. My family's still in it. They're all, you know, my parents are in their 60s. My grandma's in her 90s. And it's, at a certain point, do you just say, it is what it is?
It is what it is. If you have made peace in yourself and realized their limitations, every family system, every individual relationship has its limitations. And we have to understand, okay, what is the value of being with these people? Maybe they can get a little bit from me and I can get a little bit from them, and we can learn to peacefully coexist.
I had a very close friend who was a Jehovah's Witness, and he was ostracized from his family because of his lifestyle. He got cancer and he was dying. And when he was dying, he wanted to be with his mother again, who had died. And he thought that the only way he could do that is if he was a Jehovah's Witness again. So I brought him to the hospital Jehovah's Witness Bible, because this is what was going to give him comfort in his life.
Right. Beliefs can serve us. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, he had a very short time. And if that's going to make him feel better, why do I need to unhook his obscure belief? So I think we have to be careful when we do these things.
I think that's a really good point. Truth is important up to a point. But if no one is being harmed and it would cause more harm to hit them with the truth, then we need to evaluate that individually. Not everyone should be pulled from their religion.
And on a spectrum, like my parents are on a spectrum that is not dangerous. They are living their best Oprah lives. Like, they're fine.
Yeah.
But there's other people in that religion who are not fine. So yeah, I guess it's figuring that out.
Yeah, like how much harm is actually being caused?
Yeah.
That's what you have to evaluate. And I don't think Joe and I can tell a family of someone who's being harmed.
We want to pull that from the family. We want them to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to impose on them what it is that they feel is the harm being done by the group. Tell us. We want to know, because when we talk to your loved one, we want to make sure that we understand where you're coming from so that we can explain it to your son, daughter, husband, wife.
In our approach to intervention, we're useful to someone who's in a group if we can help them get their family to understand what they believe.
Mm.
So if we can serve a purpose because we can get them, their family, to understand something that they can't do, then we have value.
Is that how you position yourself, as not their enemy? Because you're like kind of a mediator with their family. Oh, that's really interesting. Okay.
There's the approach, and some people in our field have this approach of, you know, they come in, they say,
I'm going to give you a talking to. Sit right down and I'll tell you how it goes. And you put on your deprogrammer cape.
Right,
you know,
right.
You come in as a hero.
So some people will come and say, there's six qualities of a cult. Here's your group. There's six, it has six qualities. You're in a cult. You should leave. And that's just not us.
We have done that if it was appropriate for that situation. But we've learned over the years that in most cases, that's not the formula. There is no model specific to everyone leaving a group. If they find themselves overwhelmed by group experience, it's going to be different for each individual,
mm-hmm.
how they leave, how they approach the group, and how they leave the group.
But basically, attacking their beliefs directly, as we've talked about quite a bit on the show, it's typically not the way.
Look, attacking beliefs is one thing. Exploring beliefs is another.
Mm.
And so if we can expand the conversation into a little bit larger dialogue, you know, expand it out to the origins of where that idea has come from, the roots, that we can talk about it in other ways. It doesn't make the person wrong. And so the idea that interventionists like Joe or myself get someone out of a group is absurd. The person gets himself out. All we do is sort of help provide a context, maybe some tools mm-hmm. that for that person is the thing that maybe will help them make that decision. And so in, you know, my experience is what has succeeded. Some of this is personality driven, because it's our personalities to be more nuanced. Our personalities are be, you know, not so pushy, and we can be useful. And people will trust you if you're honest with them about what you think. But you don't have to tell somebody everything you think is wrong with a group. And that's a mistake that I think that families make all the time.
Right. It's almost like an approach of curiosity and empathy. It's not attacking the beliefs, but it's opening a dialogue with curiosity.
Yes.
So it's really a communication. So basically, you guys are just expert communicators is what I'm hearing.
Well, I think that if you look at diplomacy, that would be a little bit more of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And interfaith dialogue. So we have a good friend who a Catholic monk, and he does interfaith dialogue with a number of groups. And I was asked, we had a conversation one day, and he was doing some interfaith dialogue with Islam. So he's a Catholic. So Catholics believe Jesus is God. The Muslims do not believe that Jesus was God. So there's a, you know, a little conflict. So if they're sitting on the other side of the table, he said, well, if I say Jesus is God, the other person says, no, he's not. We get nowhere. So we try to find the common ground.
Right.
And I said, so what's the common ground? He said, when Muhammad had his vision, him and his brother went around. They were against having iconography, like crosses and icons in the churches. So Muhammad went around cutting off the crosses, getting rid of the icons. There was one icon that Muhammad's brother said could stay, and it was Mary holding the infant Jesus. So the common ground is that they have Mary, and Mary is a part of Islam. So that's where they start, the areas that we can agree on. Mm. So what we try to do is help families find the areas that they can agree on, because the biggest issue that I find is for people who are concerned about someone else's beliefs, they don't know what to talk to them about. They think they have to give them a talking to. So can we create a collection of things that are safe things to talk about so that you can have a life with someone?
That's so fascinating.
People typically think of deprogramming as the 70s thing. Can you just like briefly tell us what that was and why it was not the correct?
I mean, you're talking about freedom of thought and you're holding people against their will. That's a fundamental. Let's start there.
Interesting.
Right, right.
So I worked on a case where a kid was kidnapped off the street at gunpoint.
Whoa.
Taken to a compound in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania. I was the third exit counselor at that point. I was as green could be. I had only been doing this work for 2 months.
Oh,
but
wow.
The one who was supervising the case and this individual called me up and said, come now.
They didn't know.
And I was like, okay, I'll come and help. I didn't know what I was walking into. I walk into the home. It was a upper level general in the military, a well-known family in Washington, and their adopted son had joined a group that was a spinoff of Jehovah's Witnesses, but was its own thing. There were only 8 members. I mean, it was very small. They had met in a Bible study in Philadelphia. The kid was working at a clothing shop in Center City, Philadelphia. When he left work that night, there was a gun in his head and he was told to get in the van.
Wow.
He got in the van and he defecated himself. He was brought up to a retreat in the mountains of Pennsylvania. 5 days later, after the primary deprogrammer, whose name I won't mention, was kicked out, the next person was a woman who's since passed away named Mary Alice Kronologer, so I can mention her. She invited me to come. And I got there and
he didn't know.
I had no idea. They said he's up in the bedroom. So I go in. This is how it was. It was very, you didn't do any background on the family. You had very little knowledge. You were coming in really, you know, green. You had no idea what to expect. You walk into the room and it's sunset and he's sitting in a chair, rocking, just struggling with where he found himself. He said, you know, Joe, he just started talking to me openly and it was blowing my mind because it didn't often happen that way. I don't care if my parents are right or if they're wrong. What happened to me is unconscionable. And at that moment, I stood up. I said, let's see what we can do here. I went downstairs. I said to his family, your son has to leave and I'm going to drive him home. I lived in Philadelphia. He lived in Philly. And the mother proceeded to flip out and roll around on the floor. It was all very dramatic.
Wow.
Wow, wow.
Screaming and hollering. Oh, it was like, you know, I never experienced anything since quite like that. So it's frozen in my memory. And for the 2.5-hour ride back to Philadelphia, he just spoke with me. And the next time I ran into him in Center City, Philly, he was out of the group. I mean, he wanted nothing to do with it. Yet he also wanted nothing to do with his family. So
right.
That damage had been done.
That is so heartbreaking. His family loved him so much, too. And then he just totally fucked up.
But their guidance at that moment was very limited.
Exactly.
The people who were their first contacts had suggested this
right.
would be the best experience for them. And they knew no different.
Even I grew up thinking that that was how you got people out of cults. You know,
yeah.
The history is this. So you're in about 1973, Ted Patrick, his son gets involved with a group, and he went in and kidnapped him and got him out. So people said, oh, you got my kid out. The groups at that time, and this was the Children of God, the groups were not keeping kids away from their families. But as soon as the groups, families started kidnapping their kids, then the group started keeping the kids away from their families. So these become
right.
You know, a very weird dynamic. Mm. So they more and more started hiding people. The programmers would go, they would kidnap someone, take them. Horrible things happened on these. Mm. Somebody I went to Maharishi U with, a student, the programmers thought that the way that she would know she was out was she had to lose her virginity. And so they had sex.
Oh.
The guys on the team, not the actual the programmers, but security, who were often low-level criminals who were involved in this because, you know, they...
Yeah, who are you going to get to go kidnap someone?
You got it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But there were actually some misplaced idealists in that group as well. So it wasn't one or the other. It wasn't black and white.
It's never black and white, is it?
I know.
It's so complicated.
Yeah. So this history in the 70s was what was going on into the early 80s. And then there was a man, his name is Kevin Garvey, since deceased. And he came up with an idea of something he called exit counseling. And that was this other approach, the programming was... The idea was that there was people got into groups because it was an emotional change, some kind of snapping moment, and that you needed an emotional reaction to get them out.
Mm.
Kevin came up with an idea that, no, this is an intellectual thing. I mean, the only thing that's going to keep you out is your intellect. So he came up with a more dialogue. So it was a lot like deprogramming, except when no one was held against their will. And it evolved into something like a French salon. So when intervention would occur, there might be six of us go, and we'd sit around.
Nobody was getting paid a whole lot of money. We would all just kind of pile in and, you know, hang out.
We talk about philosophy and ideas.
That sounds great.
It's what informed our work today.
Mm.
There's sort of the history. And then in the early 90s, a couple that were Scientologists, somebody that was a very high-ranking Scientologist, the captain of Hubbard's ship, actually.
Wow.
I was working with them, and we developed the approach that we use now, which is showing a lot more respect, understanding that, you know, she had a horrible experience in Scientology, but there was also good experiences she had.
Right.
So both were true.
Mm.
So being the captain of Hubbard's ship, she could tell wonderful stories to people, like being in the Mediterranean.
He knew LRH.
Yeah,
she was there with him.
Being in the Mediterranean, and all of a sudden submarines come up because she had sailed into a Russian submarine training zone.
Oh, wow.
And they boarded the ship.
And, you know, they're this goofy Scientologist, you know, they're all on the ship looking like military. And the Russians come.
Oh, my God.
The captain for the other Russian ship said, I want to see the captain. And she went, you know, put on her full regalia. She came out and she goes, a woman captain. Only in Russia do we have women captains. And so she invited him onto the ship and they drank and they had a good time and everything was fine.
Wow.
That's an amazing story. At age 24, she had learned by Hubbard to sail a 365-foot ship across the ocean. He taught her how to do that.
Wow.
She's now 80 plus years old, lives in Florida, a beautiful woman and a dear friend.
Mm.
So that's true. And they also locked her up, you know, a chain locker, and did horrible things to her.
For having negative thoughts against LRH. So she had been at the pinnacle and had dropped down because he could no longer tolerate her individual growth. So he wanted to clamp her in.
Right.
Well, there's lots of reasons why, but the point I was driving at is that both things are true.
Yes.
Abuse and these amazing stories.
Right. So you have to acknowledge these conflicting truths.
They're both real. And so if we go in and say that it's all bad, well, for this woman, it wasn't all bad.
Right.
Because she had amazing experiences. Because what 24-year-old young woman in 1965 becomes a captain of a 365-foot ship?
Totally. Who
learns to do celestial navigation and all these things because Hubbard taught her that. But he also abused.
Right.
So life is like that, and groups are like that. And we just have to acknowledge the good part. So if you can understand, this is how we started off, and appreciate what someone loves about a group, what it means to them, then I believe you have the right to criticize. So if we look at it as art, So in my house, there's art all over the place. And if you came into my house and said, that's an ugly piece of painting, why do you have that on your wall? I would say, you know, get the hell out of here. But if you looked at it and said, that's an interesting piece of art, I wonder why the artist used that stroke. That's, you know, that's confusing to me. If you could see what I appreciated about something, then I think you have the right to criticize. But if you don't see what I appreciate about this art, the aesthetic, then I don't think you really have the right to criticize.
Cool.
I feel like this is, there's just so much wisdom in that we can bring into the rest of our lives in general.
I was going to say, thanks for saving my relationship with my family, guys. Cool hour.
I feel like I could talk to y'all forever. Well, if you're ever in Los Angeles, let's get a lunch, please.
We used to be.
Before COVID, all the time.
Before, yeah, we were there all the time.
Yeah, well, let us know if you're ever back. This is just so interesting.
I seriously feel like I want to talk to you for hours longer, and I wish we had time to do that. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you guys.
And where do people find your find information about your work?
The website is cultmediation.com.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Easy.
Love it.
Peasy. All right.
Awesome.
And cultnews101.com is where you'll find information about groups. Cultnews101.com.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
Have a wonderful rest of your day. Great to meet you both. You too, guys.
Okay.
Woo, they are so good.
They're so good. Okay, here's the question.
Give me.
We talked a bit about TM, Transcendental Meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Megan.
What?
Would you or have you ever joined TM?
Of course. Of course I did, Lola. And I feel guilty about not doing it every single day, but they helped lessen the load of that. You meditate for 20 minutes twice a day, and you have a mantra that you repeat, and I have ADD out the fucking ass, and it's really just me sitting there for 40 minutes a day doing nothing different than if I was just watching TV. So that was my experience. Although I had a wonderful teacher, I love him so much, and I had him on my other podcast, and he's brilliant, and so many people had amazing results. So I think it's just kind of knowing your brain. But you shouldn't join a cult of it or anything, but if it helps you meditate, that's cool.
Yeah, I don't like the proprietary approach to meditation. Like, we're going to give you the mantra. This is the way you have to do it. That always like raises my red flags.
Yeah. I mean, I understand people saying this is one technique that you might enjoy, but there are a lot of people who go really far with it, of like, there's some Osho quote, which I can't believe people still quote Osho since he's just like a notorious criminal. But it's like, seek your enlightenment, like your house is on fire and your mother is inside of it. And I kind of heard, not from my teacher in particular, but a lot of the community around that, is like, this is the most important thing. You have to find the uppercase S self, and it can get a little fucked up.
And as Patrick and Joe told us, there's stuff when it's an organization like that, it's important to be really mindful, because, for example, you didn't know about the belief that levitation was literally going to save the world.
Not at all.
And that's like not something they're advertising, so, you know.
Yeah.
I got what Jack calls skeptical hippo eyes about it.
I just went to a roller skating party and saw a really cute guy and did a couple roller skate rounds with him, and then realized he was a meditation teacher. And we went on a date and learned to meditate. It was great.
I will just add a disclaimer here. I love you, David Lynch, and I'm so sorry that I don't like your meditation style, and I really want you to put me in something.
David Lynch, just like and share the podcast at least, please. We're not hating.
I'm such a fan.
I mean, obviously, it sucks that so many people are so deep in, and there's these secret little aspects of it that they're not sharing, but whatever. Maybe they don't even know. That wouldn't shock me, honestly. I feel like a lot of the guys I know in Hollywood who are super into shit have no idea what they're actually talking about.
Oh, I mean, for sure. I would say most of them.
You guys, we hope you have a great week. We can't wait to see you here next time. Remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever trust me.
Bye.